Hi, this is Corey Sear from the Group Revealer. We're hanging out with WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, I guess so. I don't know about that.
We have 18 known listeners. Sometimes it's more than that.
Ellen, I just got word from the ratings group that we are the number one rated show on this station.
Who said?
Well, I kind of made that up.
We are the number one. You mean we get more listeners than anyone else?
Yeah, that's all it could mean, right?
Well, they're driving around in their cars.
That's why it's good to be on the drive
going
time
to work,
slot. Yeah.
Coming home.
Yeah.
You know, I listen to WGXC in the morning. I listen to Democracy Now.
Yeah.
And then I listen to Lincoln Mayorga.
Oh, yeah.
And then I just, you know, when I'm in the car, like you said, I just flip the channels now and then, and it's amazing, you know.
Yeah. It is. And, keep us going here, folks. You know, we're making a new kind of constant request that you become sustaining members, because it makes it a lot, or supporting members. It makes it a lot easier and will take the pressure off all these pledge drives we have to do. So if you can, yeah, as low as I went on the site, Ellen, because I'm going to, instead of giving each pledge drive, I'm going to do like you're doing, give monthly.
Well, you know, it's kind of painless.
It's totally painless.
It works through your credit card.
Right.
You have a chance at any time to change the amount you're giving every month, I believe.
Right. And it's as low as $5 a month. I mean, who can't afford that these days? It's a cup of coffee if you go to these fancy coffee places.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
Radio broadcast, this I believe.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here.
Sarah Tapton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. The question of what kind of structure would best serve as a garage for the new Greene County Jail in Coxsackie was raised at a special session of the legislature's Public Safety Committee September 16th. The garage, as proposed, is a $1.3 million building equipped with full heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system and restrooms. In March, the legislature deadlocked on whether to remove the garage from the jail plans. The Public Safety Committee Monday voted to purchase a $190,000 building for the Highway Department equipment storage. Catskill Representative Matt Lavera said, and I quote, "I don't see why we can't have this type of garage at the jail. If they're truly looking for a storage garage and not a training room or more office space, this would satisfy that need," end quote. He pointed out that the county already has a training room at the jail facility and another at the Emergency Services Building in Cairo, making any additional space redundant. Legislature Chairperson Patrick Linger said the two buildings would be used differently. He said, and I quote, "There is no concrete floor in the Morton building. They are two completely different buildings," end quote. According to Greene County Sheriff Greg Seeley, The jail's garage will be used by his office for the storage of boats, all-terrain vehicles, SWAT team trucks, and the canine unit. Linger put off further discussion about the garage until the next regular Public Safety Committee meeting October 2nd. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Amanda Purcell reports for Columbia Green Media that on September 17th, the Hudson Common Council voted to send a nine-month moratorium on new short-term lodging facilities to the Columbia County Planning Board for review. Common Council President Thomas DiPietro, a WGXC volunteer programmer, said, and I quote, "As you know, we are in the process of crafting a law that deals with short-term rentals, but in the meantime, because we want to do that correctly with a lot of public participation, we would like to propose this moratorium while we craft this law," end quote. Fourth Ward Alderperson John Rosenthal said of the moratorium, and I quote, "It does have a hardship provision. If anyone in the process is about to be putting an Airbnb online right now after the law is passed, they can come before the council, plead their hardship, and get an exemption," end quote. The other Fourth Ward Alderperson, Rich Volo, said, and I quote, "No one has seen it, a draft of the proposed law. The public hasn't seen this," end quote. Fifth Ward Alderperson Dominic Maranti, First Ward Alderperson Rob Bujan, Fifth Ward Alderperson Eileen Holleran, and Volo voted unsuccessfully to send the law back to the legal committee, with the rest of the council voting to send it to the county. The issue will be before the Hudson Legal Committee at 6:15 p.m. on September 25th at City Hall. Visit the WGXC Newsroom page to download or play the audio of the September 17th Hudson Common Council meeting recorded from a live web stream by WGXC volunteer Dan Udell. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Sarah Tapton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. In the aftermath of the judicial victory scored by Wyndham Democrats Nick Bove and Natasha Schuster, it remains to be seen if a fraud investigation is forthcoming. Bove's attorney, Kevin Maldonado, said last week the Greene County District Attorney's Office and the State Attorney General's Office will decide if allegations of election fraud are pursued. Greene County District Attorney Joseph Stanzone said September 18th, there is currently no criminal case pending against Wyndham Democratic Party Chairperson Tom Polker. Stanzone said, and I quote, "Whether there will be an investigation has yet to be determined. There has been talk of some improprieties. They may very well be an investigation, but nothing is pending per se," end quote. The Attorney General's office did not return calls for comment. Maldonado asked Bove's counterpart, Republican Thomas Hoyt, if he considered Polker's failure to get the party candidate's paperwork submitted on time to be an offense. Hoyt is the Wyndham Town Republican Party chairman. Hoyt said, and I quote, "I would have offered to take the paperwork down for Mr. Polker," end quote. Pressed further about getting involved in the matter, Hoyt maintained that he did not want to involve himself in another party's issues. Bove, candidate for Wyndham Town Supervisor, and Schuster, candidate for Wyndham Town Board, sued Polker after the committee chairperson failed to submit the required paperwork to secure their places on the ballot for the general election by the July 25th deadline. Judge Lisa Fisher ruled in their favor last week, and their names will now appear on the Democratic line in November. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Brenda J. Lyons is reporting for the Times Union. The former chief of staff for Republican first-term State Senator Daphne Jordan has filed a human rights complaint alleging the lawmaker unfairly and inappropriately terminated his employment in July. Chris Thompson, a longtime Senate GOP aide and former confidant and press secretary for former State Senate Majority Leader Joseph L. Bruno, is accusing Jordan of violating his, and I quote, basic human rights, end quote, including asking him to pull a candy wagon in a parade last March while dressed as a leprechaun. Thomas's complaint states, and I quote, "I felt that my direct supervisor, Jordan, violated my basic human rights by directing me to wear clothes not befitting of a 61-year-old grown man. Dressing me up as a leprechaun is wrong. A supervisor, let alone a sitting state senator,
should exercise better judgment than to send such images to a subordinate. I refuse to wear the clothes to the parade, end quote. Thomas said the day after he refused to attend a fundraiser for the senator in Half Moon, Jordan fired him in front of two other staff members, and he was escorted from the state capitol, and I quote, like a criminal, end quote. He filed the complaint August 20th with the State Division of Human Rights. Jordan's spokesperson, Joshua Fitzpatrick, issued a statement September 18th after a story about the accusations appeared in the Times Union, saying the, and I quote, allegations are baseless and wholly without merit, and frankly, it's very sad that a disgruntled and terminated employee would lie in such a manner, end quote. A spokesperson for Senate Minority Leader John J. Flanagan declined to comment. Read the full story in the Times Union. Amanda Purcell is reporting for Columbia Green Media. The city of Hudson and the U.S. Department of Justice are close to a settlement agreement in a case filed by three city residents alleging a lack of accommodations in public spaces required by the American with Disabilities Act. The three complainants took action arguing the city's sidewalks are inaccessible and the entrances to City Hall, Promenade Hill Park, and other locations are also inaccessible. An investigation by the federal government determined the city was out of compliance in several categories. Under the settlement agreement, the city must take remedial action within 30 days, including the appointment of an ADA coordinator responsible for investigating ADA-related complaints. The coordinator must receive training within 90 days. The city must also establish a grievance procedure for processing complaints. Mayor Rick Rector said September 9th, and I quote, the city of Hudson is working closely with all relevant parties in both reviewing issues and determining steps towards resolving those that we are able to. We have and continue to be engaged in productive meetings with various government representatives from Washington, D.C. regarding ADA compliance. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. MidHudsonNews.com is reporting the State Department, September 19th, released its jobs report for the 12-month period ending in August. The department reported a 17.1% increase in new jobs in Sullivan County, the highest increase reported statewide. The Ithaca metro area came in second with a 4.4% increase. Columbia County reported a new job rate of 2.8%, followed by Ulster County at 2.6%, Greene County with 1.9% growth, and the Dutchess-Putnam Metropolitan Division with 1.6% increase. The number of private sector jobs in the region grew by just under 12,000 to 824,000. Gains were largest in educational and health services, leisure and hospitality, and natural resources, mining and constructions. Jobs were lost in trade, transportation and utilities, and professional and business services. Holly Otterbein is reporting for Politico New York. The campaign manager for Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, September 19th, sent a letter to the Democratic National Committee urging it to demand that Governor Andrew M. Cuomo approve legislation to extend New York's deadline for voters to change their party registration. The deadline is less than a month away. Fraz Shakir wrote, and I quote, in 2016, countless voters across the state of New York were disenfranchised by the state's arcane and inexcusable early party affiliation deadline. Countless voters whose first attempt to engage with the Democratic Party saw them turned away, end quote. The state legislature passed a bill this summer to let voters change their party affiliation by February 14, 2020, but Cuomo has not signed it. A Cuomo aide said the governor intends to sign the bill into law. Read the full story at Politico New York. Aaron Croke is reporting for the Poughkeepsie Journal. The 2019 leaf peeping season has begun with the launch of New York's annual fall foliage forecast this week. The first signs of autumn color has started to appear mostly in the Adirondacks in areas like Saranac Lake, Tupper Lake, and Malone, and along the St. Lawrence River in the Thousand Island Seaway region. The fall foliage reports are based on observations of volunteer field observers. The reports are updated weekly on Wednesdays and are available at iLoveNewYork.com.
According to Cornell University, the most important factor for leaves to change color is the shortening of the day length. But how warm the fall days are, combined with how warm or cool the nights are, will determine vibrancy. The Farmer's Almanac is predicting better colors than last season, arriving right on time. Read the full story in the Poughkeepsie Journal. And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day. Your forecast for the weekend. Well, on Saturday, sunny with a high near 79 degrees. Saturday night, mostly clear with a low of around 54. And on Sunday, sunny with a high near 84 degrees. Sunday night, a slight chance of showers after 2 a.m. It will be partly cloudy with a low of around 63 degrees. So there you have your weather update brought to you by WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
There are so many events on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org, and you can add your own by pressing the Add an Event button right there on the page. If you do, folks like me will read your community event on the radio. Folks around the world will see it online at WGXC.org, including some of these events.
On Saturday, September 21st, the Way Out Gallery in Rensselaerville will be showing dry pigment paintings and photographs in Light Touch by Philippe Mazol, and will be open on weekends in September through the 22nd. Master storyteller Tom Lee uses art, objects, history, and interactivity at Olana's main house and surrounding landscape to tell a stunning Syrian folktale at the Olana State Historic Site in Hudson at 10 a.m. Arts educator, writer, director, and performer Pamela Badia reads and tells traditional stories from around the world with music and performance, and leads a related craft with children and their families every first and third Saturday, open to children of all ages at the Hudson Area Library starting at 11 a.m. CORE Strength and Balance Workshop with Phil Spector will introduce exercises that improve postural stability, core strength, spatial body awareness, sensory integration, agility, and coordination at the Hudson Area Library starting at 1:30 p.m. The City of Hudson Senior Center and the Hudson Area Library host watercolor painting with local artist Gretchen Kelly from 2 to 4 p.m. All ages, beginner and intermediate, paint from seasonal still lifes, objects, and photos. Learn basic techniques or just hang out and paint with others. All materials will be provided. Registration is required at programs@hudsonarealibrary.org. Tocotilo and Katani perform at the final event of the Spirit of the Suffragettes Summer Concert Series, a music series and community resource fair showcasing women and gender nonconforming musicians from international to local, open to the public at St. James Place in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, beginning at 5 p.m. Chris Brokaw, Bill Nace, and Kapaki's PG6 perform at Tubby's in Kingston at 8 p.m. Will Fox from Los Angeles will be passing through Catskill with full band in tow to play selections from his new album, Which Way. Eric Cardona, a.k.a. Mr. Twin Sister, is from New York City and plays electronic dream pop at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill starting at 8:30 p.m. On Sunday, September 22nd, the Way Out Gallery in Rensselaerville presents The Closing Day for Light Touch by Philippe Mazod. Yoga of the Earth is a monthly gentle morning yoga practice with teacher Stephanie Fisher and is backdropped by Olana's expansive Hudson River views at the Olana State Historic Site in Hudson beginning at 9 a.m. That's it for this week's WGXC Community Calendar. You can add your own event and hear it right here on the radio by visiting WGXC.org and clicking on the calendar link at the top of the page.
Wave Farm programs are made possible, in part, by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered in Greene County by the Greene County Council on the Arts, the Alexander and Marjorie Hover Foundation, the Foundation for Contemporary Arts, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Sarah and Sam of New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You know, I was listening to the radio, and I heard this thing!
90.7 FM. Listener-aided and abetted radio.
Greta Thunberg. Change is coming, whether you like it or not. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg has sparked a global movement with her school strike for the climate. Last year, she started skipping school Fridays to stand outside the Swedish parliament demanding climate action. Since then, she's inspired millions around the world to join her. The final two Fridays of this month, September 20th and 27th, are expected to be some of the largest global protests in history. These two strike days fall on either side of the United Nations Climate Action Summit on Monday, September 23rd. Organized during the UN's annual General Assembly meeting, which brings leaders from around the world to New York City, the Climate Action Summit aims to, quote, spark the transformation that's urgently needed and propel action that will benefit everyone. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres described the urgency of the moment this week.
July was the hottest month ever. These 5 years will be the hottest 5 years in record. We see the rising level of the ocean taking place, the highest concentrations ever of CO2 in the atmosphere. We need to go back 3 to 5 million years to get the same levels of CO2. And at that time, water level was 10 to 20 meters higher than what it is today. So we are really dealing with a very dramatic threat, not only to the future of the planet, but to the planet today.
Greta Thunberg arrived in New York City August 28th after a two-week voyage aboard a zero-emissions high-speed sailboat. Since then, she's been on the go, joining youth school strikes at the United Nations and in front of the White House, giving scores of interviews and engaging with grassroots activists, politicians, and others to demand urgent action. On Monday night, in recognition for her work linking the climate emergency to human rights, Amnesty International gave her its 2019 Ambassador of Conscience Award.
Right now, I think there is an awakening going on. Even though it is slow, the pace is picking up and the debate is shifting. This is thanks to a lot of different reasons, but it is a lot because of countless of activists, and especially young activists. Activism works. So what I'm telling you to do now is to act, because no one is too small to make a difference. I'm urging all of you to take part in the global climate strikes on September 20th and 27th. And just one last thing. See you on the streets.
The Paris Climate Agreement, signed by almost every nation in 2015, was supposed to accelerate the transition from fossil fuels to renewables. President Donald Trump announced his intention to pull the United States out of the agreement on June 1, 2017, failing to note that the earliest date the U.S. could leave would be November 2020. That's why the Trump administration has been sending low-level officials to the annual UN climate summits, where they spend their time promoting coal and other fossil fuels while energetically avoiding questions from the press. Despite the Paris Agreement, the planet as a whole continues to burn more fossil fuels. In a report issued just over a week ago, the U.S. Energy Information Administration predicted global petroleum consumption for the first time ever would surpass 100 million barrels per day in 2019. The International Energy Agency stated recently, despite legitimate concerns about air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions, coal use will continue to be significant in the future, and that coal comprises 27% of all energy used worldwide and 38% of electricity generation, they said. The rapid transition away from fossil fuels to a fully renewable energy economy will require a cooperative global effort unprecedented in history. Several versions of this needed transformation for the United States have been articulated, first in the Green New Deal bill proposed by New York Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey. 2020 presidential hopeful Senator Bernie Sanders has put forth a $16.3 trillion plan that he says would create 20 million jobs and pay for itself within 15 years. His plan also promotes environmental justice. Quote, in a truly inclusive movement that prioritizes young people, workers, indigenous people, communities of color, and other historically marginalized groups, he said. Greta Thunberg's words from last December's UN climate summit in Katowice, Poland, bear repeating. The two-week ministerial meeting was almost over. The plenary schedule was running late. At close to midnight, Greta, then 15 years old, gave a short, powerful address. She rocked the hall. Her words quickly resonated around the world.
We have not come here to beg world leaders to care. You have ignored us in the past, and you will ignore us again. We have run out of excuses, and we are running out of time. We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not. The real power belongs to the people. Thank you.
On Tuesday, after sustained protests for several years, the University of California announced it's divesting its $84 billion pension and endowment funds of all fossil fuel investments. The storms that batter island nations from the Bahamas to the Philippines and coastal communities from Florida to Newfoundland are occurring with greater frequency and greater strength. In response, a rapidly growing global movement of climate activists led by youth is heating up as well. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Welcome. We have Riverkeeper people in the house, Rebecca Martin and Sebastian Pilateri, who are helping organize a community scientist appreciation event on November 1st at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. We're really excited to have the Riverkeeper here in Troy. We have so many issues of concern having to do with the water. And I'd like to ask you each some questions having to do with your role at the Riverkeeper. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Rebecca, you are the campaign coordinator and the senior campaign coordinator for the water quality with the Riverkeeper. Could you please tell us a little bit about the Riverkeeper, for people who don't know what it is, and the water quality program?
Sure. So I've been with Water Quality, now the Water Quality Program, for almost 3 years, and my role there has been to help to take the community science that our team collects over the course of a year. The data is a good 10 years now, right? So what we try to do is find solutions to the problems that are identified through the testing that we do. So I usually am put right on that, on the case there, and work on different projects to help rally the citizens and elected officials in the area and the locations that we've identified. Riverkeeper is an organization that's 50 years young. We work within the Hudson River watershed. I don't know how many square miles that is, but from the headwaters.
14,000 about square miles.
14,000 square miles, and that covers quite a bit of area and where people live and work and play, as well as the New York City drinking water source area, which is the Ashokan Reservoir. Mm-hmm. Outside of New York City.
The water from New York City all the way up to?
To Mount Marcy is the headwaters of the Hudson River.
All the way down to the harbor, so, and out to sea. Mm-hmm. The water quality program is something Sebastian can speak to very well, and why we're here today.
Yeah.
Yes, please tell us. We've heard that you have literally 400 testing locations, and you're working with volunteer community scientists.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, we have this great network of partner institutions, laboratories, community groups, about 47 in total. And so we work with all of them and our volunteers, and we go out from May to October once a month in a lot of locations, sometimes weekly in others, to take water samples. And our goal of this program is really to find out how can we connect people back to the river. And so we want to look for indicators that tell people whether or not it's safe for swimming. So we specifically look for Enterococcus, which is an indicator bacteria that tells us whether or not the water could be safe for swimming.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And so this event that you're organizing for November 1st is going to celebrate the community scientists who are doing the testing?
Yeah, people dedicate a lot of time to this program. You know, in the Upper Hudson that we just sampled yesterday, volunteers spend 6 hours sampling 150 miles of river in one day. And so we really want to show our appreciation for that, the hard work that they put in, the hard work that other volunteers put in. And so we're having these events, one here in Troy, one in Kingston, one down in Yonkers, and then possibly one up in Glens Falls as well.
And we're so happy to partner with you with all of the things that you do here, and being right at the mouth of the Mohawk River on the Federal Lock. It's just such a great place, and to meet more of the community mm-hmm. that's right here, that's impacted, right? That so it's for our community scientists, but we hope to also get to meet a lot of your community, the community that uses the sanctuary space, so we can make more connections and you know, be more effective in the work up here.
Right, and I assume one way that we could connect is to have new volunteer scientists. How does a person get started? If a person listening to this interview wanted to become a community scientist in your program, what is the process?
You can go to our website, riverkeeper.org. There you can find, I'm listed at my email on the website under Community Science Coordinator. You can email me directly. You can also sign up for our mailing list, and we'll send out emails. And on that email, we have a link to a survey. You can fill out that survey, and depending upon where we need volunteers, if you guys fit in terms of location geographically and our needs, we can get you involved with water sampling.
And you can also come to the event.
Yes.
On November the 1st to meet some of our community scientists and our team, and we're going to be showing Source to Sea, which is one of the films that John Bauermaster has made focusing on the river and in Riverkeeper's work. And get more information that way.
Are your community scientists trained as scientists, or can they be anyone? Could they be from other worlds? How do you train them? And can you tell us a few little stories about some of your community scientists and what they do?
They can be from other worlds. We actually encourage that. You know, my background in and of itself, I studied economics and political science. So, like, doesn't matter if you don't have a science background. And we typically see a lot of people who have come to community science because they want a way to get connected to the river again. And so if you have a passion for the Hudson River, if you have a passion for water, if you're interested in learning more about your environment, if you want to connect to a location or a spot,
A tributary that runs into the Hudson.
And if you have a cooler and some loose ice and are willing to take us some time out to learn how to be trained, you can get involved with the citizen science program, community science program.
And then how much of a commitment is it in that period of testing?
It depends on where you're sampling, but typically people spend about 2 to 3 hours every sampling event. And so we sample once per month. So that's about 2 to 3 hours a month, more or less.
That's so exciting. So we are talking to Sebastian Pilateri, who is the community science coordinator, and Rebecca Martin, who is the senior campaign coordinator. They're both in the water quality program of Riverkeeper. Mm-hmm. And we have had personal experience with the Riverkeeper several times. We're excited to build our collaboration. But a few years ago, our youth went, and our youth activity of Uptown Summer Program went to John Lipscomb's boat. Mm-hmm. And he showed us what he's doing, and we met with him, and it was just so inspirational. Can you tell us about some of the people who work with Riverkeeper and how they do outreach in the community?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just say a little bit, but I think Sebastian can speak to it more, too, because John and Sebastian and Jen Epstein, who is also one of our scientists, spend a lot of time with John. But Captain John Lipscomb is on the river, up and down the river, from top to bottom. How many months of the year?
From April to November, depending upon
yeah. Yeah. Seems it's his full life.
And it's what's so significant about it is that he's the only one. And it's a watchdog. And it's also he's beloved. And mm-hmm. the boat is beloved. It's got Riverkeeper on the sides. Yes. And he patrols the shores and, you know, where the water comes in and et cetera, and helps to, you know, people know that there's John Lipscomb coming up and down the river to keep an eye on what's happening and also build relationships mm-hmm. with the people in the communities up and down the river. John is, everyone knows John Lipscomb, it seems, where when we get to go on the boat with him and patrol, it's so inspiring.
Yes.
So he is our Pete Seeger.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, in essence, that's the way I think of him. He's that sort of an inspirational figure who knows the issues of the river, unlike, you know, well, very few do, and mm-hmm. John's one of them.
Mm-hmm. Right, and John lives it every day, but mm-hmm. I assume that as the campaign coordinator and also as the community science coordinator, mm-hmm. One of the challenges is that you get all this data, mm-hmm. but what do you do with it? I'm wondering mm-hmm. if we could spend a little bit of time, our final question, talking about that challenge and what are your hopes as you move forward with your organization?
Well, we'd love to see. So our data, we use it a lot in terms of advocacy, and we've used it to push to have New York State implement or pass legislation to provide much more money, $2.5 billion for funding of infrastructure. But what we really want to see is how can we use it to empower volunteers, empower community scientists, to be able to go and advocate for themselves, advocate in their community, and really speak to these issues.
Well, we thank you for being here, and we hope we can continue to talk to you because obviously we could go on and
there's
on.
A lot to say.
We love the Hudson, and thank you for helping protect it and helping educate everyone about it.
Thank you so much.
WGXE always needs computer donations. If you have an old one you don't need and it is either a Macintosh 2011 or newer, 2.0 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, or Windows 2012 or newer, 2.4 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, email info@wgxc.org for more information.
This is ARRL Audio News, your weekly summary of news highlights from the world of amateur radio. If you retransmit audio news through a repeater, listen for the Morse code K character, followed by 4 seconds of silence. That's your cue to stop transmitting so that your repeater timer can reset. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY. Carla Pereira is on assignment. In ex parte comments filed on September 17th in docket 16-239, ARRL renewed its request that the FCC delete symbol rate limits for data transmissions in the amateur radio service rules.
As it did in its initial filing, ARRL asked the FCC to couple the removal of the Sybil rate limits with the adoption of a 2.8 kilohertz band limit. In response to a 2013 ARRL petition for rulemaking, the FCC proposed deleting the Sybil rate limits, but declined to replace them with the 2.8 kilohertz bandwidth that ARRL wanted. ARRL's remarks also addressed issues raised by other parties. Quote, "The issues discussed with the parties are outside the scope of this docket and would require a further notice of proposed rulemaking before final consideration. Some of the same issues are also raised in petitions for rulemaking on which the Commission has sought comment. Given the policy as well as factual disagreements evidenced on the record, we understand that the Commission may decide to consider some of these issues," unquote. The Mount Diablo Amateur Radio Club Disaster Recovery Program for the 2018 Carr and Camp Fires has made a $1,000 grant to the California Amateur Radio Linking Association toward the cost of rebuilding one of its destroyed repeater sites. The CARLA network of repeaters provides coverage across California and western Nevada to provide reliable communication during significant local, regional, and wide area incidents. The MDARC Board of Directors has established a fund to assist organizations that have suffered ham system losses as the result of the fires, and it continues to seek additional clubs with fire damage systems that may require financial aid to rebuild. The club recognizes that many of these repeater systems are in critical areas that otherwise may have very little amateur radio or cellular coverage and are vital in providing important disaster traffic. Well-known Canadian radio amateur Jay Allen, VY1JA of Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, has announced that he's retiring from ham radio, citing long-term health issues and hearing loss. The familiar VY1JA call sign has also been retired. Allen will begin dismantling his station and antennas as early as this weekend. His last contact was with KA4UPI on September the 14th. He has uploaded his logs to Logbook of the World and sent copies to his QSL managers. For years, VY1JA was an eagerly sought multiplier in the ARRL November sweepstakes and other events, as well as a needed DX zone in contests. AMSAT reports that an Antares 2 launch vehicle will carry 15 CubeSats into orbit on October 21st as part of a NASA educational launch of nanosatellites. Some of these will carry amateur radio payloads. For example, TJ Reverb, developed by students at Thomas Jefferson High School in Alexandria, Virginia, will carry a 145.825 MHz APRS digipeater. HuskySat, a University of Washington, Seattle project, will be boosted into a 500-kilometer orbit via the Cygnus external deployment device. HuskySat will carry a linear transponder provided in cooperation with AMSAT. Radio World reports that the People's Democratic Republic of Korea has resumed testing digital radio broadcasting on the 80-meter amateur band after a two-year absence. North Korea is transmitting with the Digital Radio Mondial Protocol. The latest transmission was on 3.560 MHz, and it began in mid-August. According to radio enthusiasts in the region, the signal has been very clear and very audible. Radio World says the Voice of Korea, the North Korean International Broadcasting Service, has conducted DRM trials on and off since 2012. In DX News, WH0RU will be wrapping up their expedition on the Mariana Islands this weekend. You also have a few more days to catch 6070 in Somalia, C21WW on Nauru, and E51SFS on the South Cook Islands. It looks like this weekend is going to be particularly active for special event stations. Here's a partial list. K2R will be on 40 meters celebrating 150 years of Rutgers University football.
K4MIA will be active on 17, 20, and 40 meters, commemorating POWMIA Recognition Day. Listen for W3M on 17, 20, 40, and 80 meters at the 19,000-year-old Meadowcroft dig site. W3L will be celebrating the saving of the Liberty Bell on 20 and 40 meters. W5P will be on the air from the Plano Balloon Festival on 40 and 20 meters. W4CA will be celebrating the construction of the Blue Ridge Parkway on 40 and 20 meters. NM5HD will be on the air, both figuratively and literally, on 20 meters for the EAA Chapter 179 fly-in. Look for N2R on 20-meter sideband during the New Jersey Royal Rangers District powwow. M3M will take to the air from the National Museum of Industrial History on 40 and 20 meters. K7T will be remembering Apache warrior Geronimo on 40 and 20 meters. You'll find W0ALX on the air from the Runestone Museum on 20 and 40. W1M will be operating for scout camps on the air on 20 and 40 meters. W3GBH will be active on 20 and 40 for the Skyview Radio Society Founders Day. It's the 75th anniversary of the Voice of America Bethany Relay Station near Cincinnati, and WC8VOA will be taking to the airwaves on 20 meters. And finally, listen for K8FBI on 20 and 40 during the Flying Beers Fall Fundraiser. You'll find complete QSL information and more in the September issue of QST Magazine. If you're in the mood for a ham fest this weekend, you have your choice of several. You'll find hams gathering in Lincoln, California, Hutchinson, Kansas, Peoria, Illinois for the ARRL Illinois State Convention, Alexander, Maine on Saturday and Windsor, Maine on Sunday, and Ferndale, Michigan on Sunday. All the details are in the Conventions and Hamfest section of the September issue of QST. And now with this week's satellite update, here's Bruce Page, KK5DO.
From the AMSAT Corporate Secretary Clayton Coleman, W5PFG, we have the results of the AMSAT Board of Directors election. This is the first time that AMSAT did both mail-in ballots or digital ballots. The choice was up to the member. 892 ballots were cast electronically and 160 paper ballots were cast. Jerry Buxton, N0JY, Drew Glassbrenner, KO4MA, Patrick Stoddard, WD9EWK, and Michelle Thompson, W5NYV, will serve on the board for 2 years. The first alternate is Brennan Price, N4QX. The second alternate is Howard or Howie DeFelice, AB2S. Both will serve for a term of 1 year. FO29 is still experiencing difficulties. The command stations are asking for reception reports from the telemetry to be sent to OPER@JARL.org. The beacon is on 435.795 MHz CW. FO29 is one of the older satellites launched August 17, 1996. This is Bruce Page, KK5DO, for the ARRL Audio News.
This is the ARRL Audio News propagation forecast for Friday, September 20th. There are still no spots on the sun, and the solar index is stuck at 68. The good news is that geomagnetic conditions are fairly quiet. The next chance for a disruption will be coming early next week. Now that we've entered autumn here in the Northern Hemisphere, conditions on the low bands are starting to improve, especially on 160 and 80 meters. Look for your best DX conditions there. On VHF and UHF, that hotspot for tropospheric ducting is still hovering over Illinois, Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio. There may be some eastern movement next week, but if you live in that part of the country, keep your ears to your radios.
And that concludes ARRL Audio News for this week. Our thanks to all contributors to this week's report. ARRL Audio News is produced by the American Radio Relay League, the National Association for Amateur Radio. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at ARRL.org.
You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment about ARRL Audio News, email us at audionews@arrl.org. This program is copyright ARRL, all rights reserved. 73, and thanks for listening.
Find out where the music takes you on the next Deep Threes as Arturo Farrell, DJ Logic, and the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra mix it up in Cuba. Three-quarter piece makes a jazzy, diplomatic overture, and the Entrio takes a long acoustic holiday. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes Mondays at noon after the news on WGXC 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
Jelena Guo, can you talk about your work as a staff attorney at the Immigration Law Clinic?
Sure. Primarily, we've been working with youth and victims of crimes such as domestic violence, sexual assault. We've also now recently been exploring ways to get more involved in appellate work, because a lot of the cases that wouldn't ordinarily have been denied, we are now seeing denials for those. So that's where we are thinking that we can make the most impact in this day and age. So we do have a couple of appeals, cases where the clients have been previously denied their immigration status, whether it be in immigration court or with another immigration agency. And because we're part of Albany Law School, we're first and foremost an academic institution. So a lot of our work is driven by students and our learning objectives for students. So myself and also the director of our clinic, Professor Sarah Rogerson, we directly supervise the students in the work in those types of cases that I just described.
Can you talk briefly about how the U.S. treats immigrants past and present and where that fits into where we're at right now?
Yeah, we've had a very complicated history as a nation with immigration and with the idea of who we are in terms of our national identity vis-a-vis the people who are trying to come and enter our borders. This really started, you know, very soon after the War of Independence. And there's been various points in our history where we've decided to exclude certain groups based on ethnic or national origin from either being eligible to get citizenship here or from even entering our country in the first place. So if you think about it, the 14th Amendment was only enacted after our Civil War. So almost for 100 years after we gained our independence from Great Britain, we had African Americans, Native Americans, other people of color here in our country who were born here, but who did not have birthright citizenship because the 14th Amendment hadn't been enacted yet. There were also points in our history where we openly and very obviously excluded certain groups of people from Asia, such as the Chinese with the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was only appealed less than 100 years ago. We've also had times when we've been openly hostile to groups of people depending on who we were allied with during times of war. So it's really reactionary based on current events. And I think we see that nowadays with the Muslim ban, with the asylum policies at the border, with refugee policies across the world. So it's not a surprise. I mean, it's kind of like a pendulum where it kind of swings one way or another.
And just continuing on that, people have a lot of opinions about immigration right now in our country. It's become quite political. What are some common myths around immigration?
I think a lot of the myths center around immigrants and their ability or willingness to work or contribute to our society. A major myth that I think the Trump administration has really been behind is that immigrants don't work and that they don't pay taxes. And in fact, that they, you know, take social welfare and benefits from well-deserving Americans, quote unquote. And that's simply not true. Studies have actually shown that immigrants contribute around $40 billion to our New York State economy. And that's in the form of their work in various industries, blue collar and white collar. So, for example, hotel, hospitality industries, construction, agriculture, farming, all the way up to white collar professional office setting jobs. I'm talking about undocumented immigrants. And that they, in fact, also pay about $1.1 billion in state taxes, state and local taxes of New York. Immigrants are contributing. They want to pay taxes. They want to support and find means to support their families and their children. So that's a major myth that I think needs to be debunked, not just in New York, but across the nation. Other myths, you know, include that immigrants don't want to learn English or they don't want to assimilate. And that's also not true. I mean, numbers have shown that immigrants really are trying to learn English, that the majority of them have some fluency or competency in our language.
Just bringing our conversation up to some specifics. DACA is going to the Supreme Court this fall. What do people need to know about DACA and what has happened with DACA under the current administration?
Sure. So DACA refers to Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's a really interesting type of status because it's actually not written in any of our immigration laws. So it's a form of what's known as prosecutorial discretion, where during the Obama administration, the executive department decided to issue a memo saying, you know, starting from this date, we are going to consider prosecutorial discretion for this group of people under these eligibility factors. And it's continued to this day, not in the same shape or form, unfortunately. And it was really kind of a compromise because we didn't get comprehensive immigration reform. We didn't get Dreamers. You know, we didn't give them a pathway to lawful status. And what DACA does is that it allows people who fulfill the eligibility factors, usually immigrants who are brought here as children, to get two-year work permits, which have to be continuously renewed because they expire. It's not a pathway to getting a green card. You know, it's just kind of its standalone program. And what's happening now is that in 2017, Trump announced that he was going to rescind the entire program because the entire program was supposedly unlawful to begin with. And there were a lot of court cases about this mess. And what resulted was various injunctions against the government saying they cannot do this right now. This is a matter that has to be resolved legally in court. And while that's happening, DACA recipients should continue to have DACA status. And that is what happened. Right now, DACA recipients are able to renew their status, but there was somewhat of a compromise in that if you've never applied for DACA but are eligible, you are not able to apply right now. There are no new applications. Before, DACA recipients could also apply for something known as advanced parole, which is kind of telling the government that, you know, I'm a DACA recipient, I'd like to travel abroad during this period of time. May I have permission to do so and come back to the country? And now it's off the table as well. So the Supreme Court this fall is hearing arguments surrounding Trump's attempt to rescind the program. And that's significant because if they say, yes, he did have authority to do so, that implicates the entire program. And we as a clinic right now, we have several DACA clients. And I know we're watching this very carefully because what the outcome will show is, you know, how we're going to counsel our clients about their immigration options. Do they have another option if DACA is somehow eviscerated? But that's kind of the precarious stage that we're at right now.
So I guess we need to stand by to November? Is that
what
we're looking at?
Yeah, so the oral arguments are scheduled to be in November. Decisions probably won't come out immediately. It'll probably be several months, so maybe sometime in 2020.
Trump is also talking about zeroing out the refugee program. What does this mean for refugees?
So refugees are people who seek asylum protection, but who are outside of the United States or not at our borders. So they're different from asylees, right? We hear in the news about asylees in the Mexican-American border seeking protection. Refugees are seeking the same type of protection, but it's just a location difference. So every year, the president sets what's known as a refugee cap for every fiscal year. This is the total number of refugees from across the world that the U.S. is willing to accept. And that cap has steadily decreased since Trump has been in office. In the last year of the Obama administration, the cap was 110,000, fiscal year 2017. Now, in fiscal year 2019, we're actually down to 30,000, which is, you know, a significant decrease. The new fiscal year of 2020 is coming up, so we're going to hear, I think, in the next couple of days from the administration an announcement about what that refugee cap will be. But there are rumors that it could be down to zero, and members of Trump's administration have expressed their desire to make that number zero in fiscal year 2020. This would mean that the U.S. would not be accepting any refugees from across the world, potentially increasing the burden on other countries to increase refugee intake. This could also mean that there are many refugees who have been separated from their families who are in America, who had the expectation of being able to be reunited.